Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, March the 4th. We are getting closer and closer to spring. I'm your host, Magnus Tiewold. With me today is...
Peter Raymond Haskell. Peter R.H., too. Go by.
Awesome. We are here. We got some interesting stuff for you today. In a few moments, we're going to play an interview I did on Thursday with Tracy Letts of the organization Mom Stop the Harm, talking about the BC Coroner's report indicating that over 2,500 people died of opioid overdoses in 2023. And then later on in the show, what are you going to talk about, Peter?
Well, actually, I just got some stuff on the Bank of Canada. I actually met the one previous to the Bank of Governor of the Bank of Canada at the Vancouver Institute lecture a year ago.
Yep.
And he contended there was no change in 1974 to the Bank of Canada, but I think that there was. And basically it was that we basically borrow from the international banks, Canada, instead of borrowing from ourselves. But right. He denied it, but the CBC, in this thing about the lawsuit, the Comer lawsuit, Committee for Monetary Generic Economic Reform, that kind of fizzled out. They tried to do a lawsuit to return the Bank of Canada to the state that it was, and it kind of fizzled out, the lawsuit. But I was kind of expecting, when we met him before he did the lecture, I was expecting to say, well, that was the right choice.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he told us there was no change. But the CBC on their website seems to infer that there was.
All right. Well, we'll be talking about that in the last 15 minutes of the show or
yes.
so.
Yes.
Ayu Sakamoto is also coming up today to do her weekly arts report. So she'll be here at about 10:35 to talk about what she was up to on the weekend. But let's get going with our first interview of the show. In January, the BC Coroner released a report on the opioid crisis in British Columbia for 2023, 2,511 lives were lost to toxic drugs in 2023, almost 7 people per day. We're in the 8th year of a public health emergency as declared by the province, and yet the problem only seems to be getting worse year to year. Mom Stop the Harm is an organization very close to the crisis. It is made up of parents and loved ones and family members of people struggling with addiction. Tracy Letts is the BC Vice Chair for Mom Stop the Harm. And she is, in fact, like many other members of the organization, the family member of someone struggling with addiction. And, in fact, her son passed away this year on the 29th of January, in the time between the release of the coroner's report and our opportunity to do an interview last week. So this is a subject very close to her heart and to her lived experience, and I think it's an important viewpoint. This is my interview with Tracy Letts. Oh, that's not it. Other one, just sec here. All right, joining me now is Tracy Letts, Board Vice Chair of Mom Stop the Harm. Before we get into things, maybe you can tell me, what is Mom Stop the Harm?
Mom Stop the Harm is a pan-Canadian organization that all our members generally have experienced harms one way or another with somebody's that they love substance use, right down to, you know, supporting people that are in active addiction, as well as those who have lost their loved ones.
Great. So last month, the BC coroner announced or released their report on the opioid crisis in 2023. And we set a new record of opioid deaths in BC of 2,511, or almost 7 deaths per day. Why aren't we making more progress on the opioid epidemic?
I think, you know, the drug supply is getting increasingly toxic. And I think in general, that is unprecedented. People don't really know what to do on this. Like, if we look back on Lisa LaPointe's report, one of the first, or the death review panel, one of the first things that she said is that we need to address the toxicity of the drug supply and to curtail the deaths. And by doing so, to do that in an appropriate way would be to introduce a legal regulated supply, or maybe not legal, but a regulated supply of substances that people are using at the moment.
Right. There's a lot of contention around what to do about the issue. There was just in Richmond earlier this month, there's a proposal to open a safe injection center, which met a lot of public opposition. And was ultimately turned down. What do we need to, how do we address, you know, the public's fears around treatment for addiction?
Well, I think it's a matter of, it is fear. And it's fear of the unknown, and fear of that this could happen within your own family, and fear that it is happening and you don't know what to do about it. And it doesn't help that we're also getting a lot of narrative out there, particularly in the press, from certain political organizations and groups that seem to, you know, have grabbed onto this and are perpetrating that fear within people. So, you know, what happened in Richmond is just a lack of knowledge, a lack of education amongst the citizens there. And I think that is something that when, you know, you're looking to propose a site such as that one, and I was really surprised that they went about it in the way that they did, bringing it through council in that regards.
In what way?
Well, generally, you know, health authorities have a lot of leeway in what they can and cannot put on in their own institutions and on their own land. And I know within, say, Fraser Health Region, you know, opening up an OPS or a safe consumption site is something they can do without council's approval.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the way they went about this instigated a lot of fear in the community, because lack of understanding of what it actually entails, what a safe consumption site is or an overdose prevention site.
Yeah, I guess opening it up to a sort of political forum really changes the nature of the discussion on the issue.
It generally does. So it comes down to, like I said, putting in a site such as that should start at a grassroots level, and it should start with educating the community around it. And that just didn't seem to be done at this point, and particularly in Richmond. There was a huge amount of opposition, and it, from what I understand, it also got fairly nasty, mm-hmm. what was happening there. And like, it is, it's based in fear, it's based in the unknown, and a perception of what people who use substances look like and how they act and who they are. And that fear is being spread, you know, through certain right wing, I hate to say that, but right wing organizations and media. And it's really, it just compounds the stigma, and it compounds isolation. And it is a leading contributor to people dying.
Yeah, there's a great deal of othering that goes on in the discussions around addiction. Certainly, you know, what I heard people saying through the media on the Richmond discussion, or the you know, the council discussion there, involved a great deal of othering of who are people with addiction. Mom Stop the Harm is very much an organization that is very close to the issues of addiction. And that's the case for you as well.
It is. You know, this isn't an organization that you just kind of look up online and decide, I'm going to join this today. Every single one of our members has lived experience, whether it's with addiction ourselves or with people that we support and that we love. And it's also one of the main goals of Stop the Harm is to reduce deaths, stop the dying. And we really look at that and do that through education. So we educate our membership, we go out and we educate in public, and we just kind of look at reducing the stigma and the fear that surrounds that. It's if we look at Lisa LaPointe's report again, you know, they've identified 225,000 approximate substance users in the province of BC. And out of that, the majority of them, and we can look at about 80%, if not more, just based on the data that's out there, are either using in isolation, using alone, and are not the typical, you know, like what we're seeing in media, seeing, you know, the photos that end up being out there. There are also not the people that are going to be using a safe consumption site. They may stop by, pick up harm reduction supplies. But it's the face of somebody struggling with addiction is my face. It's your face. It's the face of so many people out there. And the majority of people don't know, and they don't understand that.
And you've personally experienced the loss of addiction to addiction.
I did. I lost my son this past February.
I'm really sorry to you've had to go through that.
Yeah, I am too. Sorry.
I bet. What can you say as a parent who's lost a loved one, lost a child, to people who don't understand what we need to do?
You know, I get a lot of people that come up and just, I think, because I do talk about it. And I think that's the number one thing is we have to talk about it. We have to talk about addiction and just substance use in Toronto. And we have to teach our children and we have to educate youth on what substance use is. And it's not the typical DARE programs. It's not, you know, the things of the past. Obviously, that hasn't worked or we wouldn't be in the crisis that we're in now. But I think education and open conversation is really the way to start this. Reduce stigma around drug and substance use, and learn to talk to your kids and provide a safe space for them to be able to come to you with their questions, with their concerns, and react in a way that knowledgeable way and not just off the cuff out of fear. So yeah, for me, it's, you know, in my journey, when I started on this, I had no clue what was going on. And it has been a really long curve and journey that my family has gone on and I found that the more I learned, the more I educated myself, the more I found that I was in a better place to be able to love and support moving forward, to answer the questions, to look for resources. And it kind of brought our family back together.
You mentioned the number 225,000 users in the province. I mean, the nature of the toxic drug supply is that any one of those people could find themselves in an overdose situation. It's not about people who've maybe experiencing long-term addiction or very, I don't know what the right term is for, but are really in the clutches of addiction, but really anyone who's a user could be vulnerable.
Any single person in this country at this moment who uses a substance purchased from the illicit market is at risk of death. There's no getting away from that. It is so adulterated and that people have no clue what they're buying. They have no clue what dosage that they need to use. They have no idea of if this could be their first or last time using a substance.
That's pretty stark.
It is. It's like a game of Russian roulette. You know, my son, I mean, he was in addiction. He identified with an opioid use disorder. He was under care of primary physicians. At the same time, he also had a very high tolerance to certain opioids through just prolonged use. And it took him unawares. He didn't know. I mean, his toxicology report when it came back had high concentrations of a benzodiazepine, as well as fluorofentanyl and fentanyl. And he had probably no idea. He was just buying what he normally would buy, and it was that just that one last time.
That's really hard. We're coming up to a provincial election in the fall. I mean, what in Mom Stop the Harm's recent press release, you call out all the parties for their failures in addressing the issues. So what policies and changes are you looking for from our political leaders as we head into a political campaign?
Policy-wise, you know, we work closely with a lot of government organizations. We sit on a lot of committees. And one thing I found in the last year is those committees are getting smaller and smaller, and they're not including people with lived and living experience in the same way that they were originally. And I think within any crisis, you need to include the voices who are directly affected by the crisis on hand. And I think with policy change, like the one that we've called out numerous times, is to have a robust, regulated system of treatment and recovery, which we don't at the moment. Our recovery industry or our treatment centers are non-regulated. And that's a concern. That's a huge concern, because without regulation, they're not being monitored, they're not being evaluated in a formal way that collects the data that we need to do to make the decisions that we need to make. So there's no data informing the decisions. There's no evidence behind the treatment that's being provided. And I know as a parent whose son had been in and out of treatment, that the options available to me it was amazing. I went online, went on to Google, boom, all these paid ads came up. You start working your way through them, but there was no way for me to evaluate outcomes, to know where my money was going, how successful have they been. And we still, and that was in 2014 and 15, and in 2024, 10 years later, we're still in that same situation. So there is no way to know where people are going, what the programmings are around, are they unique, are they individualized, and how it's hard to measure success, but it would be nice to know how many people start and complete a program, how many people within 2 and 3 days have actually had a fatal incident once they've walked out of treatment. Like those are that's the type of data we need to have.
And so that's often one of the most dangerous periods for addicts.
It's an extremely dangerous period for anybody, and it's on par with those who've been incarcerated. You know, the first 24 hours, that first 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, you know, we start looking at that, and we increased morbidity and mortality is associated with abstinence-based programming, whether it's through jail, whether it's through treatment centers. So, you know, being able to look at that data and see and make informed decisions, I think, is extremely important. That's one thing that Mom Stop the Harm really does support. We also support a regulated supply of substances for those who need them, not necessarily in a medicalized model. It could, because when we look at the rates of addictions haven't changed. So we have 225 self-identified drug users in this province. That doesn't mean we have 225,000 people with addiction. Right. That means we have people that just use substances. And so if we pathologize and medicalize everybody that uses a substance, it doesn't work. It doesn't, you know, it really doesn't correlate. So we need to have options available for everyone. So if you identify with an OUD, you want to go, you know, you need medical help, you need that medicalized model to move forward. But what about those, you know, the young couple who are celebrating, just, you know, graduating from grad school, that want to use cocaine? They're just as at much risk of dying. And so if we could look at regulating a certain amount of supply for those who are not in addiction, because 80% of those people who are dying in their own private residences, generally, a lot of them are not in addiction.
So is the indication then that levels of use are not necessarily connected to availability of supply? I'm talking about in the general sense, like.
Well, no, I mean, it levels of use. So I think anybody can walk out the door and get supply that they need. That's not an issue. It's getting a supply that won't kill them is something completely different. Right. And so there's a lot of programs. They're not a lot. I shouldn't say that. There are more and more programs being made available to people in addiction, with an identified opioid use disorder, that can get alternatives. And those alternatives are more on the harm reduction side. So we're talking about methadone, Kadian, Suboxone, et cetera, to help them with the withdrawals and with their addiction. But those who don't have addiction, who don't have a dependency, there's nothing available to them. And they're still going to use drugs. And that's the thing is, people have been using drugs since antiquity, and they're going to continue to use drugs. So we need to figure out a way that people can use substances in a safe manner that's not going to kill them.
So what would you say to, the party leaders, if you had an opportunity to sit down with them, about what needs to be done?
That's a tough one. I think just some honesty would be great from party leaders. Truthfully, let's look at the evidence. Let's follow the research. Let's really dig into what is going on and work in a nonpartisan way. And how do we address this? And not do it as political pandering. And don't take one group of people and further marginalize them based for political points. And I think that's exactly what's happening. And, stirring up the pot to create fear, to create votes, it's just so wrong on every level. And the ethics are really concerning when it comes to that. Basically work on a nonpartisan solution on what does work, because it affects so many families and so many individuals that, if we look at the data behind that, what is it? 1 in 10 families are affected by someone's substance use. And if we could stop demonizing it and reduce the stigma and show some positivity towards action, towards solutions, that would really go a long way, but they're not. So as it stands right now, what would we say to the different politicians? Would be just kind of stop demonizing people. Let's come up with some solutions. Let's work together. Listen to the voices that need to be heard in this crisis. And stop building political careers on the backs of people that are the most vulnerable in society at times.
Are there jurisdictions we can look to in BC or elsewhere that are doing a better job of dealing with the crisis?
There's different jurisdictions around the world. I mean, Switzerland has done a much better job of dealing with the crisis. Portugal has put in, with their model that they have there, that it seems to suffice with them. The one thing that North America has that the rest of the world doesn't have is fentanyl and its analogs and the toxicity of the drug market. Place else in the world actually has, they still have heroin, they still have cocaine, they still have methamphetamines, but they are a lot safer than what we have here. And so it's really hard to look at those models and relate them back to what we're going through. They don't have I think that's just what it comes down to, is that the actual, when fentanyl was introduced, the toxicity increased. And the harder their enforcement to keep fentanyl out of our country has actually made it even more toxic, as they're looking to different precursors that are going into the drug supply.
I feel like that's perhaps a bigger question than we have time for, but why is it a problem here if not elsewhere?
I think at the beginning it was our proximity to the Asian market. A lot of this was coming out of China, and it is highly, highly addictive in a way that it wasn't before. But what was coming in, and I think that's what took people by surprise, is one, the potency, and it doesn't last as long. Like, fentanyl doesn't have the legs that, say, heroin did, et cetera. So you're using more on top of it. The dependency is increasing. And then so as they started to, more enforcement on keeping fentanyl out, and COVID was a prime example of that, is when we really shut our borders down. People had to, they started looking at alternatives. And so those alternatives were being found here within the province. And instead of importing a lot of what we were doing, they started, actually manufacturing a lot of the substances here with what they could get their hands on and what they could easily get brought in. So if you increase border patrols, or if you increase that kind of, you lock that stuff down, the iron laws of prohibition actually are telling you that you need to decrease the size of what you're trying to do. You need to, there's just, it actually increases the toxicity the more you increase the enforcement.
Right, which is sort of a catch-22.
It is.
How do you address it? Which I guess points to other solutions rather than enforcement, which gets us back to the issue of making the supply safer and providing treatment.
I think that's exact, for us in the organization, it's one is making the supply safer. And that's something, and ramping up the response to this. And, it's so highly politicized. And even I look at what the NDP is doing right now, government, if they've backed off, they've decided we're going to go this route because that's what what community wants. That's what the general public is saying. We need more treatment. We need detox. We need this. We need that. Well, we do. We need a robust system of treatment and detox, but we also need to keep people alive until they can get to treatment and detox. We don't have enough beds in this province. We don't have enough space. We're still looking at 3 weeks, 6 weeks to get into detox for a lot of places. We have minimal detox centers. A lot of treatment centers won't take anybody in until they've gone through detox. And one thing we know about addiction and in this crisis is when somebody decides, I want help and I want it now, we have to be available. We have to be able to respond now. And we don't have that capability right here in the province to do that. And particularly when you start looking at remote and rural communities, we look outside of, the little urban centers. So whether it's Vancouver or Victoria, Kelowna, Prince George, even Prince George is, doesn't have the resources that they need. And it's kind of just compounds the situation. So, I think, and I lost track of the question. I'm sorry.
I guess perhaps is, in addition to the sort of specific failures of approach, is part of the issue just an unwillingness to spend the money or provide the resources needed to attack the issue aggressively?
I do believe that they've put a fair amount of funding into this. I think that they start a program or a project, it gets out of the gate, they do it as a review, like everything, and then the outcomes might not be what they want, they shut it down. So instead of, unlike other things, instead of saying, okay, this is working, but it's not working exactly how we want it, so let's tweak it a little bit. They say, okay, this kind of works, so we'll just shut it down and try something new, instead of kind of taking the models that you have and enhancing them and putting more resources into it. We just keep shifting in all these little pilot programs across the province. And those little pilot programs really only can, accommodate up to, say, 100 people. So if we have 225,000 and maybe out of that 100,000 are looking to actually eventually stop using substances to get into a treatment program, we don't have that. We don't have the facilities for people, nor do we have facilities that work in a way that address people's unique issues. Like it's kind of that one size fits all in so many places. This is what we do and how we do it. Whether either you conform to how we do it or you're out. And so most people are like, we're out then because we can't, that it's a big part of the problem. So no, I don't think it's a lack of funding. I think it's a lack of continual funding and actually funding programs that work.
Right.
And that comes down to evaluation, right? We need to monitor, we need to evaluate, and we need to collect data. And that's, we're not doing it in a way that is beneficial.
So, as someone who's seen the crisis up close within your own family. What would you say to our listeners, to, you know, the regular person who doesn't have that experience and knowledge you have? What do they need to know about this crisis that might help them see clear what it is and what we need to do?
You know, this crisis gets a lot of attention and gets a lot of media, and I think people are tuning out to it, and which is really makes it more difficult to for any kind of progress or forward change. But if it happens in your family, or if it happens to someone close to you, because there's a good chance in your neighborhood and on your cul-de-sac that there's two or three houses that this has affected those families, is that just a little bit of compassion, some caring, really start to educate yourself and start to look at people that use substances. They're people. They're just individuals. They're like everybody else, every other family. Like my son, he played hockey. He played baseball. He went to high school. He, you know, they just the normal, everyday, average teenage kid, and grew up in a time where OxyContin was quite popular during that. So I just think that you need to educate yourself, to open your mind to the fact that we have stigmatized substance use for so many years. We moralize it when it's not a moral issue. It's an issue, a medical issue, when it comes to addiction, and that we need to just kind of look at it a little bit differently. When people need help, they need help. When people ask for help, we need to have help available for them. But like you said at the beginning, for me, it comes down to education. Like, really look a little deeper, look a little past what your inherent biases are. Maybe also think a little bit about what your relationship is to substances and where you stand on that, because we can look at substances as being alcohol, caffeine, tobacco, illicit drugs, prescription drugs, and also recognize that a lot of youth that get started in this need a safe place and somebody to talk to about, and that most youth try substances in the home the first time. And that's something we need to be prepared to discuss. So talk to your kids about, we talk to our kids about safe alcohol consumption. You know, if you're going to go to a party, how do you drink? What should you do? You know, that type of thing. Well, we need to talk to our kids about safe drug use at the same time, but do it in a way that you're not just condemning them if they even think about doing it, but in a way that they're kind of from the educated point of view saying this, you know, there are substances, you're going to come across them, you know, kind of approach it that way. And I think that, you know, for me, I keep coming back to education. Educate yourself. There's so many resources out there that do that. There's so many different organizations that are willing to help, like, you know, Moms Stop the Harm. We get new members. Our organization is growing by leaps and bounds, and we don't, in a way that is just heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
That we get probably anywhere between 5 to 7 new members a week from across the country. And it's really hard to justify what we see that's happening politically to what we know is happening within people's families.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, and I'm very sorry for your loss. Can you tell me how people can find out a bit more about Moms Stop the Harm?
Okay, you can just go online. It's momstoptheharm.com, and there's a lot of different links on there to resources. We do have support groups for families. We have a bereavement group that's Healing Hearts, and we also have support groups called Holding Hope, and they are operated both in person and virtually across the country. We also have sections with, you know, different areas of resources, you know, that you can utilize and educate yourself with. And you can always reach out to us at info@momstoptheharm.com or here in BC at bcmomstoptheharm.com. And there's always somebody on the other end of the line that's willing to talk to you, particularly if you're in crisis. There's always somebody that will get back to you.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Tracy Letts is the board vice chair of Moms Stop the Harm. Thank you for speaking to me today on such an important issue.
Well, thank you for having me.
Moms Stop the Harm is a national organization working with and on the issue of the poison drug crisis, which is affecting us very much here in British Columbia and in the Vancouver area. the BC Coroner report on 2023, 2,511 people died from tainted drugs, not just opioids, but as Tracy mentions in that interview, just about any illicit drug these days has the potential to be tainted with substances you're not expecting. We're 8 years into the public health emergency on this issue, and nevertheless, things do not seem to be getting better. That tragic number, 2,511 deaths in 2023, seems to go up every year. And for all the talk and all the public concern, we don't seem to be winning on the problem. Thank you to Tracy Lutz for speaking to me and Mom Stop the Harm for the work they do. Tracy Lutz is the board vice chair for the BC chapter of Mom Stop the Harm, and I spoke to her on Thursday last week, February 29th. Let's take a quick look at the weather.
Yeah, it snowed.
It did snow.
It snowed yesterday.
I lived sort of closer to downtown, near the water.
Approximately Main Terminal, right?
Yeah, in that area, right?
Yeah.
So we got a bit of a slushy stuff coming down, and I drove all the way down to the ferries and back yesterday.
That was out yesterday evening, and it was snowing in Burnaby.
Okay. So, yeah, it wasn't any snow near where I was or where I was traveling yesterday, so I was really surprised to arrive up here this morning to... It's very much a winter wonderland up here.
Well, winter, we'll put it that way.
Well, you know, there's snow everywhere up here at SFU, and it's still on all the trees, so it's got that sort of beautiful winter look. It's not snowing now, but who knows what's going to happen. Well, you know what? Mm. Environment Canada has a bit of an idea about what's going to happen, so why don't we look at that? Well, it's... the forecast this week is for sunny with clouds through most of the week. More chances of snow tonight in certain areas. It's going to get down to negative 4 degrees, and we're going to have negative temperatures overnight till for most of the rest of the week, until Thursday or so. But pretty warm in the daytimes with highs up to 6 or 7 degrees, including all the way up to 8 degrees. On Thursday, and then things are going to get a little warmer but wetter come next weekend. So if you're coming up here to SFU, expect the snow, and who knows what will happen elsewhere, because the weather forecast is just that, a forecast. Do you like the snow, Peter?
Not particularly.
I always kind of like it in Vancouver because we don't get a lot of it. So it's fun for a few days, especially if it's nice snow. I'm not such a fan of...
We don't get hurricanes either. I don't want it to come at least once in my lifetime either. So.
I've never experienced a hurricane. That's probably a good thing.
Yes.
All right. Time for Bird Note. And then we'll be back with Peter. What are we going to be talking about very quickly?
Well, I'm going to talk about the Bank of Canada, actually.
Right.
And then maybe the Federal Reserve. Yeah, you know, it'll be a bit of what I talked in the beginning of the show.
Okay. We'll be right back after Bird Note.
Okay. This is Bird Note. What did chimney swifts do long ago, before chimneys existed? Back then, there were many big hollow trees for swifts to roost and build their nests inside. Swifts can't perch with their tiny legs. They can only cling onto a rough vertical surface, like the inside of an old tree, or a brick chimney. Over the last few centuries, land developers cut down old-growth forests with large hollow trees. Chimney swifts began using human-built structures, which probably gave their numbers a boost. But building styles have changed, and traditional brick chimneys are becoming rarer. Flying insects, which swifts depend on for food, have dwindled due to pesticides. Fortunately, we can provide habitat for swifts right in our neighborhoods. If you have a brick or stone chimney, you can allow swifts inside by keeping it open on top with the damper closed from April to October. Avoiding pesticides in gardens helps make sure swifts can find food. You can also learn how to build a wooden tower designed for chimney swifts on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote is provided by Claudia and Bert Toth and generous listeners around the world.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is...
Yes, we don't need that music.
No. Here on the CJSF 90.1 FM, Peter, the Bank of Canada.
Well, I met the previous Stephen Politz at the Vancouver Institute with his free lectures over at UBC. This coming Saturday, there's going to be another one, 8:15 p.m. on Saturday. I don't know the topic, but it's kind of hard to get there. They are at the Woodward's Medical Building, and that was the construction. It's kind of hard to tell people how to get there. But the thing is that you can sometimes, it's free, meet some high-profile people. And we actually, last year, I did meet the last one, Stephen Politz. Now, he was Canadian governor of the Bank of Canada from 2013 to 2020. Now, during this period, there was an attempted lawsuit by the group. It's called the Committee for Monetary and Economic Reform. COMER is their short little abbreviation. And they wanted to restore the Bank of Canada, that it was not... That they were giving interest-free loans. Now, the thing that happened, that when we met him, it was a group of us that are into this thing, and I had heard it a number of years, and so he was a pretty well-dressed guy. We figured there was previous to lecture starting. We figured this is the former governor of the Bank of Canada, and so we said, do you think that was right to change it? He told us straight up there was no change. None. Like, as I said.
So to change from what to what?
It changed that we're basically now really connected with the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland. Yeah. And we weren't previously to 1974 connected up there. We were basically borrowing from ourselves with interest-free loans and the provincial governments and certain infrastructure, and supposedly the St. Lawrence Seaway was one example, the Trans-Canada, World War II, partly, hospitals and universities after World War II. So this Comer group thought we should go back to that. We should have the interest-free loan. It's like if you're borrowing from your parents, or you've got a credit card and it's no longer your parents that you're borrowing from, to make maybe a metaphor.
Yeah.
But what was interesting just now, because I was getting a few things straight before, and then I saw on the CBC, it basically says what I had heard over the years, what I'm telling you, with the changeover. But so we thought he would say, no, it was a good change to have, but he categorically told us there was no change. And I think, I don't know, I can't explain this, because the CBC is a governmental thing also, and they have it more of this other line. So, okay, we kind of covered that for now. I'm going to talk about the Federal Reserve, which was established 1913. Mm-hmm. Ours was established 1935, the Bank of Canada. And supposedly it was 1938 before they did a lot of here in Canada. But I'm going to tell you, one thing that sort of goes counter to none dare call it conspiracy, and I actually
But they quoted Life magazine from 1949, and this was supposedly the backup that J.P. Morgan had manipulated the 1907 panic, and that, you know, and he did this to establish the Federal Reserve and so on. So I said, well, I can go to the Central Library and read the 1949 Life magazine because they have it.
Yeah.
So it was basically a book excerpt. And briefly what happened, which they don't really say in Under Call Conspiracy, was there were two deep panics, 1893 and 1907 states. Now, these were deeper than a 1929 stock market crash, except they were dealt with because they were about money itself, whereas the 29 was about stock value. Right. This is about values of money itself. And
One of the things that I think many people don't understand that well is that, or is not that well known, is that in the 19th century, the 1800s, there were regular economic crashes that were really quite severe. I mean, they weren't, you know, as you say, they weren't, you know, the Great Depression was different because it had a slightly different basis and it went on much longer, which is why it's the Great Depression. But these sort of economic crashes and panics were pretty routine.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, maybe you know a bit more than I do on that one. No, but I'm just saying that it was the funnel. It was the currency itself was that issue. So what happened was that what I read, what had happened, which I don't really say in Under Call Conspiracy, but I'm going to tell you briefly what it was that J.P. Morgan was semi-retired by that point.
Yeah.
It was at some Bible conference, actually, and they told him, hey, you got to get back to New York City. There's a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it was pretty serious, and so what happened was that J.P. Morgan had some people, high finance people, and then they had he locked them in a room at his mansion, supposedly played solitaire while they came with some sort of concept, and then he would say, no, that's the wrong concept, go back and think it again. This happened a few times. So what it was, they said, well, you, J.P. Morgan, buy up U.S. Steel, like a majority stock in it, which was against the antitrust regulations at the time established by Theodore Roosevelt. So he went to Theodore Roosevelt and said, it is going against your new antitrust regulation, but we feel this is how to subside the panic.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was basically done. So the Federal Reserve in 1913 was kind of established to not have J.P. Morgan so much part of the economy as such. But he was, as it were, still like an actual influencer, of course. But that's not sort of said in the more reactionary things about it. Anyway, so I'm giving you a bit of a balanced view in general. But here comes something. One thing that they always bring up, maybe our listeners also hear Coast to Coast AM with George Norley. They may have even remembered Art Bell. But one thing about the Federal Reserve is that a lot of people make up is that it was Jekyll Island where they went to form it. So then Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, of course. It's Dr. Jekyll. So actually, okay, Mr. Hyde's the monster anyway.
Yeah.
But this is actually established. That happened was that these high-level people didn't want to be seen going there. And they were like having a duck hunt. One guy even brought a shotgun, supposedly. Yeah. So it was a bit undercover. Some people go to the extent that it didn't go past legislation and so forth. And that it's unfair that way. But it is sort of established that it was undercover, the very bringing forth of it. But I can add a few other things here. Might as well.
Sure.
You didn't come today.
No, unfortunately not.
No, I'm ready for this.
Good. Have some music we can play too.
No, okay. We'll hear some music.
Okay.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
That would have been a good one to have up, and then we'll be back to continue our conversation in just a moment. That was Ruby Singh in a track called A Wolf in Cedar's Clothing. You're listening to Speak Up, and we got just a few minutes left in the program. Democracy Now! Is coming up at 11 o'clock, and coming up at noon, you'll find Wandering Rhythms with Nick Legacy. Peter.
I'm going to finish off, you may wonder why that strange pyramid figure is on the back of the United States $1 bill.
Yep.
And I don't think I brought this up on this show previously, but I have the whole story on it. So what it was that that thing was the pyramid and the eye.
So it's like, yeah, it's like a pyramid.
Yeah.
And then on the top, there's a little section that's different. Maybe it's not even quite attached. And then there's an eye. It's a very strange.
That was developed. In fact, the very artwork itself was the late 18th century.
Yeah.
And the other side of it, which is like a circle, which was kind of was originally kind of be a coin thing. You have the eagle, and that eagle was the branches or whatever it is. That's on the back of the American $1 bill also. Yep. So those things were kind of more to be a coin kind of thing.
Yep.
And that was the very image of it was developed 18th century, the graphic representation. So what happened around 1937 or so? He later became vice president under Franklin Roosevelt, but he was Department of Agriculture.
Who was that? Was his name?
Well, I forget his name. Anyway, but he said to Franklin Roosevelt, he said, "Oh, you only see what the eagle presented. Why don't we do a special coin that has both? It has the pyramid thing and the eagle thing." That was just to be a commemorative coin. Yeah. And then Franklin Roosevelt got the idea of putting it on the back of the $1 bill.
Yeah.
And he went to Roman Catholic leaders who might be offended by that rather odd thing. And supposedly Franklin Roosevelt had a Mason's background. But they say Washington, D.C. is built on Freemasonry.
I was wondering whether the Freemasons and whatnot were going to come into this.
No, but I don't put much thing that they're that important. But yeah. I just thought in the moment to hear it say that's why it's there. And that's how they did it. It's kind of an odd thing. I would have just sort of said don't do it myself. But I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means that he chose to do it, because it is odd to put it there.
It is odd, and it's funny because it's often a symbol that's associated with the Illuminati, which is, I'm not even sure if people take that idea seriously or not, but they talk about it a lot, right? The Illuminati, some sort of secret society that controls the world.
I don't really go with the Illuminati theory.
Oh, I know, but I mean that symbol is often associated with that too, so which leads to people to...
Well, it's actually, as I said, the imagery, it wasn't just somebody didn't draw it up because it was already done.
Yeah.
This is the American Revolution or whatever they're sort of thinking. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's much importance to the Freemason aspect, which does exist. Franklin Roosevelt was a Mason, and I think the Father Bush was a Mason too. But anyway, just to finish it off, it is a bit odd that they got it on there.
It is odd, and it definitely provides a lot of material for people who want to read a lot into all this different symbology that they see in different places, and then they associate it with groups like the Masons and secret societies at Ivy League colleges, which are just like student clubs. But, you know, there's all these different things that, you know, people start reading in these connections, whether it's anything we're to take seriously or not.
Well, I mean, there's other things to take seriously, like the World Bank, IMF, and other things. But I thought to put that. But I don't know. Yeah. Like, in Latin, it says New World on the pyramid on the top and the bottom says New World Order, and it approves of our undertakings. This entity approves of our undertakings. That's okay. If you translate, do people still study Latin? You can find out for yourself.
All right.
And go to the United States to get a $1 bill.
Cool. Well, it's a fun bit of trivia, Peter. Thank you very much. My name is Magnus Tiewald. With me is...
It's Peter Raymond Haskell, Peter R.H.
Yeah, and we'll be back next week. Hopefully, Ayu will be here with her arts report. Coming up in a few moments is Democracy Now! At the top of the hour. Wandering Rhythms at 12 noon, and typically Tuesday, a new episode will be up at 3 o'clock. And lots more here on CJSF. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening.